So, in this session, each speaker will have 10 minutes and then the discussion begins. I'll be wandering around with the handheld microphone to get your questions the old-fashioned way. As mentioned, you can also text questions on that number and I will play with them or not. So to kick us off, our first speaker is Winley Toe, principal at Taylor Fry. All the speakers' details are online in the conference details, so I won't give a wonderful long introduction the way Lindsay gave me, because all the speakers have much better CVs than I do and it makes me feel inadequate. Also, it saves time, you can look up the details later. Most importantly, among many things, Winley Toe is responsible for RADAR, Taylor Fry's annual insights into the insurance market. So, over to Winley Toe. Please welcome her.
A bit shorter than Michael. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be the opening speaker for the General Insurance Seminar 2016. My aim today is to set the scene for the general insurance landscape and to bring out some of the abiding themes and the key issues that general insurers face today. So it's a great time to be doing this talk because these are challenging and exciting times for our industry. Yes, as insurers and insurance actuaries like myself, we are used to the business of managing risk, so we're used to challenging, facing and managing challenging landscapes. But I find that more and more, there are greater shifts and unknowns in our own landscape. I mean, as we've seen with Brexit and Donald Trump, I mean, the whole world is a shifting landscape. When I was trying to put together this presentation, there was very little, I was hard-pressed to find any part of the insurance value supply chain that wasn't under competition or under challenge in some way by entrepreneurs touting new ways to lower risk prices or to make claims management more efficient or to engage better with customers or indeed new ways of selling or creating premiums. On top of this, I think insurers are facing reasonably challenging times in our traditional markets. There's limited premium growth, and the economic environment is also very challenging with very low returns. So today I will touch on what I consider to be the sort of key issues affecting general insurers today. One, overcapacity and competition. Is there a respite in sight? Two, a little bit about the impacts of climate change. Three, what's the right strategy for dealing with the big explosion in data and in technology? And lastly, the flip side to all this data and connectivity, cyber risk, fraud, and privacy breaches. So who and what will it take to ride high in this storm of challenges? The first topic, a tough few years. When will the cycle turn? Okay, it's fair to say it's been a tough few years, particularly for commercial insurers. There's abundant capacity, there's significant competition, and what this has resulted in is premium rates falling and loss ratios, particularly for motor and property. I mean, sadly, what this has meant is insurers focusing their energy and attention on protecting market share rather than putting in the efforts on, say, more meaningful endeavour. So is there any reprieve in sight? What do I think? Will the cycle turn? Well, I think a number of issues may provide a catalyst for this to occur. The first is the stick, regulator scrutiny. Just last month, APRA member Jeff Summerhayes said in a speech that they would increase their regulator intensity or scrutiny if the trends continue to worsen. But on top of that, they've given some best practice guidelines on this area. So clearer articulation of strategy for insurers, better alignment of prices to this strategy and closer board involvement. On top of this, you know, underwriters have had a fair while of this underperformance. So as time persists, my feeling is that they would be better able to understand and identify these unreasonably low rates and to act on them. So this gives me cause to think that the cycle will turn, albeit slowly. But the overcapacity in the markets isn't going away, so I think it's not yet time to celebrate. So in this climate, efficiency and underwriting discipline will be key. So the next topic I want to move on to is climate change. Are we feeling the heat? I'll be very brief in this topic because the next speaker is the expert, but I think it would be remiss of me, given that it is one of the major issues of our generation, let alone for insurers, for me not to even say a brief few words on this. So I think the very real and well-accepted risks of climate change have the potential to significantly affect insurers' business models worldwide. In Australia, I think we have to be super vigilant because we are the developed nation most exposed to natural perils. Insurers looking to thrive in this unstable climate will do well to, I think, engage on the potential, in discussion on all the potential risks, and also know what data to collect and be well prepared for some of the flow-on impacts of higher premiums or higher solvency requirements. Okay, let's move on to big data. So I'm touching a little bit on everything here. Master of all, master of none and, you know, great in doing everything else. So big data in technology. I was never good at metaphors. Anyway, big data and technology, perfect conditions for driving change. So despite this uncertain environment, or perhaps because of it, the investment in innovation insurance is increasing momentum. So why is this? So there are three reasons, I think, for this. One is significant advancements in technology. The fact is we can now do it. We have the means to do it. Secondly is the explosion of big data. We collect data not just in policy forms, but by Google, by, you know, drones, by social media, smart TVs and so on. And thirdly, the reason is people, ourselves. I mean, we want everything done now. We want everything customized to our own experience. And we're willing to share, you know, divulge information. Think social media, you know, Twitter, Twitter, Facebook, you know, LinkedIn. The fact is we love talking about ourselves. So technological advancement, big data, and us, people's changing behavior, all coming together to create the perfect storm for disruption and change. So here's my unscientific research, sample space one, myself. To know the pace of change, I just have to think about the new insurtech words I've learned in the last, or techie words I've learned in the last 12 months versus my whole life prior. So one of these is all about blockchain networks. Hands up, who knows how blockchain networks work, and particularly in an insurance context? Go on. One, okay, two. Well, I know there are two papers, so there's at least two people here who know about blockchains. And smart contracts and distributed ledgers. Okay, who has used the word insurtech quite naturally in your daily language as a matter of course? Go on. Oh, well, a few more, but I guarantee you'll use it more. I found that in the last year, more and more, anyway, I've had to learn some of these words as we come across more insurtech companies that are looking to expand in Australia. Here's some numbers that's more scientific than my sample space of one. So CBS Insights, their venture capital database, they recorded 50 insurtech companies in 2011. And now we're 5 years later, Venture Scanner, which is a firm which analyzes technology-powered startups, is currently tracking 981 insurtech companies globally. That's like over 900 in 5 years, right? So technology and innovation is happening now. It's happening fast. Now I want to cover fraud, the flip side of this. It's always been bandied around that 5 to 10% of all claims are fraudulent. So I came across one interesting innovation that tries to tackle fraud. That's peer-to-peer insurance. So as we all sit here now, about 5 kilometers away in nearby Paran, the German carriers are coming. The Friend Insurance, which is the P2P German carrier, they're busily building their team in a warehouse loft with $20 million of seed money, and they will launch soon. The idea of P2P insurance is that the P2P insurer pools its users into groups, so it might be friends, family, people like us, you know, work colleagues, to share risk, say, for their home contents, instead of paying a traditional insurer to take their risk individually. So at the end of the year, if nobody makes any claims, they give a chunk of their premium back. Another company called Lemonade, only in the US, it's meant to be a refreshing change, has launched in New York just about a month or so ago, and instead of giving the money back to people, they give it to a charity of that group's choosing. So the idea is that The idea is that people are less likely to defraud or make exaggerated claims on their friends or colleagues than they are, or charities than they are of some faceless traditional insurer. So, and so costs will be lower. So that's the idea of this technology. So will P2P work here? Well, will it succeed? I've got no idea. But what I do like is people are trying to combine technology with appealing to the better sides of our human nature. And that's a nice thing, to tackle fraud. So in summary, for data and technology, I think the time is ripe for driving change. And to exploit these new technologies, savvy insurers will be looking for the optimal mix of building the technological capability, or acquiring the innovators that are coming, or forming the right partnerships. In other words, making the right friends, which I think is always a recipe for success and happiness. Okay, on the subject of driving change, driverless cars, I think this deserves a quick mention because it has the potential to turn the motor insurance industry on its head. The technology is really well advanced. Did you know that if you book an Uber in Pittsburgh in the US, you call your Uber car in the usual way, lo and behold, you might be paired up with a driverless car at random. How fun is that? So driverless cars are going to be a major disruptor to our industry. And it raises many questions. We can't ignore it. Will claim frequency be affected? Who will be at fault? Will it be the occupant, the car manufacturer, the systems manufacturer, the GPS network? Well, all challenges for our industry to work through. Now, lastly, I want to move on to the flip side of all this data and connectedness. A couple of things. Cyber risk is at the top of concerns amongst businesses worldwide. A Lloyd's study of Cambridge showed that we are at risk up to $16 billion in cyber damage over the next decade in Australia. Although one of the latest speakers told me $16 billion is far too low. And they say that Sydney is at greatest risk. But before Melburnians start to smirk and think, you know, Sydney is just terrible, Melbourne, you're next at risk. So one of the recent largest attacks happened 3 weeks ago. These great cyber attacks affected popular websites like Netflix, Twitter, PayPal. So what was the attacker's secret weapon? Well, they use all these Internet of Things. So I've got a list here, security cameras, smart TVs, thermostats, even kids' toys, these Internet of Things. So many of these devices have no or little security, so they're very easy targets for hackers. So I had this frightening thought. If I'm watching my TV, my smart TV, is someone there watching me? You know, if you remember 1984, George Orwell, it was good. Just another minute. It's more real than you think. Did you know that Netflix collects a lot of data about you? It not only knows what you're watching, where you're watching, or what device you're watching it on, even knows whether you're a violent brute. You know, if you think again about you want to rewind and watch that saucy bit or that violent part a couple more times, someone is recording it and someone knows. So remember that. So only a few insurers offer cyber insurance in Australia. I think insurers can benefit from maybe broadening their product offering to cover cyber risks, but must also keep a firm eye on their own systems. One other downside of collecting personal data, the last one, is privacy breaches. I think this is a challenge for governments to make sure the data that's collected is correct, to make sure it's appropriately used and it doesn't have negative social impact. So in Australia, the government has this year developed a draft guide to big data and privacy principles, but they're still consulting and working through the details. So in conclusion, with all this brain power and endeavor, you know, by governments, by actuaries, by data scientists channeled into insurance, ultimately we must make sure it's accessible to people and businesses who need it most. On my way over here, I sat next to a really smart lady on the plane. Her name was Dr. Patricia Berwick, an anthropologist. She's advised industry and governments around the world. When I told her I was heading, luckily I didn't tell her I was speaking at it, heading towards a general insurance conference, she said, "Oof, insurance will be dead in 20 years. Nobody will be able to afford it." Well, that sharpened my focus for my talk today. So to conclude, there are enormous challenges facing our industry today, but there's also tremendous opportunity. Our challenge as an industry, in my mind, in riding through this perfect storm, and as we bash through the hail and the noise and our very clever models, is to never lose sight of why we're here and why we're doing what we're doing, is to help people in a time of unexpected calamity and to make sure they're not facing those times alone. Thank you.
So if you weren't worried to start the day, where are you now? And when Lee's really up today, imagine what it'd be like if she was feeling down with those list of things to be concerned about, the challenges posed for this industry. And now it gets worse because our next speaker used to be a journalist. Oh, no, don't hold that against her. She's reformed. Katie McKenzie is manager of investment and governance at the Climate Institute. And if you think you've had a bad day, Donald Trump, of course, has exposed that climate change is a Chinese conspiracy. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Kate McKenzie.
Thanks, Michael, for that introduction. And as I'm the first person speaking today to be using slides extensively, we'll find out if they're all working. And thanks, Windley, for that excellent speech. I was really glad to see that I was put on the challenges of today session rather than the challenges of tomorrow. I still regularly encounter people who think that climate change is something that's only going to affect future generations. As you can see from this animation, that's not really the case. We might not see every year warmer than the previous year, but the trend is very clear. In fact, next year might be slightly cooler than this year, but there is no doubt what's happening. In Australia, what that means, the average temperature across the country has increased 1 degree since 1910. This is from the latest update by Bureau of Meteorology and CSIRO. And as you can see, it's more than 1 degree in some parts of the country, less in other parts. That's a really important thing to keep in mind, is that often when we hear about climate change, we're hearing about things like 2 degrees. Really, really important, and as actuaries, I think you'll appreciate this. Those are global annual averages. People don't experience global annual averages. They experience weather and they experience extremes. And if they're unlucky, they experience disasters, which is particularly pertinent to this sector. And I do think that's something that is often lost on people. Now, I borrowed this slide from a really world-leading climate scientist called Andy Pittman, who leads an ARC Centre of Excellence at UNSW. This is illustrative, he points out, not predictive, but we're not even at 2 degrees, and we have already seen in some areas extremes, anomalies during extreme events of up to 10 degrees, such as heat waves in Russia. And the science indicates that extremes in some areas will be 1.5 times the local mean. So, as you can see, the trajectory that we're headed to currently is around 4 degrees, so it's that middle column. There's about a 1 in 10 chance that we're headed towards 6 degrees, in which case some areas, even at 4 degrees, it's not really clear whether we can adapt to that at all. The Paris Agreement that was signed by virtually every country on Earth in December should put us on track to about 3 degrees under the existing commitments, and the whole structure of that agreement is that each country ratchets up their ambition. I can get onto the Trump effect later, if people are interested. Which you probably are. And just again to highlight the importance of very small increases in the global average temperature, the difference between a 1.5 degree increase, which was the kind of stretch goal agreed in Paris in December, the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is probably the difference between the Great Barrier Reef having a shot at surviving or not having one at all. You probably are all a little bit familiar with climate change and climate science. I thought I'd just give you a little bit of information about how climate science has advanced in the last few years. One thing that's really interesting is that it's now possible, scientists can now make probabilistic attributions of specific events to climate change, so they can determine the extent to which climate change might have played a role. So, for example, these images are from something called the World Weather Attribution Project. You can look that up. It's a really good, really interesting site. And this is basically a bunch of scientists who can analyse events very quickly. The Louisiana floods of a couple of months ago were 40% more likely because of human-induced climate change. The Great Barrier Reef bleaching, they found that it was very hard to model that really, really extensive bleaching event without considering climate change. European rainstorms, depending on the precipitation events, it was between 40 and 80% more likely because of climate change. So again, it's mostly probabilistic. There's a few events where it's where it really is hard to see how they could happen without human-induced climate change. One of those events is the Angry Summer of 2012-2013 in Australia, which some of you might be aware broke a lot of weather records. It was impossible to model that without including human-induced climate effects. Five teams of scientists tried and they couldn't do it any other way. Another development is that climate models are becoming more granular, more regional in focus. This is from a paper published by some scientists at UNSW last year looking at effects of increasing urban density in Western Sydney and how that might combine with the effects of climate change. It's quite interesting, but one their findings were interesting, but another interesting thing is that it demonstrated using grid squares as small as 2 square kilometres, which is something that really couldn't be done until quite recently. So what does it mean if we want to avoid this? You all probably know. We have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and the most difficult one is carbon dioxide, because we emit it in so many of our day-to-day activities. If we wanted to have a sort of decent chance, actually, you know, depending on your risk appetite, if we wanted to have a two-thirds or more chance of staying below 2 degrees, we could continue our current emissions trajectory for about 25 years, and then we would have to go straight to zero. If we wanted to have about 50% chance of keeping it under 1.5 degrees, we've got about 20 more years, and again, then we have to drop to zero. That kind of sudden drop is not really feasible, as you can probably imagine. Probably better if we have a smoother trajectory there. In Australia, what does this mean? The existing government target that was put to the Paris Agreement is for 26 degree reduction by 2030. That takes us to that red dot. And then to get to what we effectively have signed up to, along with the rest of the world, which is zero by 2050, you can see it's a big drop. The blue line is the ALP platform, which is somewhat better. But again, it could, you know, could really start kicking in a bit earlier to make that drop less steep. Really don't want a big steep transition. The more, you know, the steeper it is, the more disruption we're probably going to see. So how are institutions around the world who are not climate scientists or not populated by climate scientists responding to this? The Financial Stability Board, which is the G20's body made up of all the G20 financial authorities, was asked by the G20 last year to consider the implications of climate change for financial stability. As you can see, they found that it it did pose a risk to financial stability, and as a result, they set up an industry task force to develop a set of disclosure guidelines for companies to report their climate risk. And the goal of that is that investors and all market participants can start pricing climate risk in, so that we don't have, we don't face disruption, we don't face dislocation that then becomes a systemic risk. People in the security world have been talking about climate change for quite some time. This is just one quote. You can find more, including ones from Australian defence experts and officials. The Pentagon announced in January, for example, that they're going to be including climate risk in all their considerations from weapons testing to war planning. So, what does this mean for the insurance industry, general insurance? So I often get people asking me about the insurance industry in my job. They usually either say, oh, insurers must be all over this and really well prepared for it, or they say, oh, insurers must be really exposed to it. The truth, I think, is a bit more complicated than that, as you will all know. This is a nice quote from a speech by Mark Carney last year, who's the chair of the FSB and governor of the Bank of England, just acknowledging that the industry has, is good at understanding tail risks and also appreciating that the future might not necessarily reflect the past. Public perceptions are not necessarily the same, however. We saw with the big East Coast low event a few months ago that destroyed some, created these very amazing pictures of mansions being really damaged in Sydney's North Shore. We saw that some of those people were very upset to find that their insurance didn't cover that. And in fact, it seemed that not many people really knew up till then that general insurance in Australia usually doesn't cover actions of the sea. And I think it echoed to some degree some of the sorts of things that we saw in North Queensland over the last few years when premiums rose very closely there. If you think that headline is a bit unfair, you should see some of the News Limited coverage around the North Queensland insurance premiums, where they basically mounted a campaign to bash incumbent insurers. So, even policymakers maybe do not appreciate the roles of risk in premium pricing. Now, I know Winley mentioned, it's risk capital is fairly cheap at the moment, but might not always be the case. Something to keep in mind. And I think that actually brings us to the end of my speech, which I got to much quicker than I thought. Fantastic. So, what can you do? So, one thing that I find a lot, I speak to a lot of people in the financial sector, in the private sector and on the public side as well, policymakers and the like, what's really important to appreciate is that this is a pervasive change. I see it as very similar to the kinds of digital disruptions and developments that Winley has already touched on, really interesting, moving very fast. And it's a big thing to get your head around if you're already expert in your own field. It's quite daunting, I think, to sometimes have to deal with a whole other area and one that's moving very fast. However, don't be misled into thinking that you have lots of time and that you'll hear about it in time to start thinking about it. The time is now to start thinking about this. There are resources that you can draw on. The Actuaries Institute has a really good climate change working group, which will be publishing some materials soon. Sharon Jitt's doing a session touching on some of this tomorrow, which I would urge you to all attend. That quote in the middle, "it takes forever and then it takes a night," is from a very eminent late economist, Rudy Dornbush, talking about the Mexican currency crisis of the 1990s. Like a lot of crises, people kind of saw it coming, and yet markets were still caught unawares. And lastly, don't be like Kodak. They saw it coming, but they couldn't move fast enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie McKenzie. Don't be a Kodak or work for a newspaper company, maybe. Yeah. Now, look, there's a lot of pressure on Katie Spirit because, really, the only hope in this session after the miserable things we've been hearing so far is perhaps there's been an improvement, or there is improvement on the way in diversity. Katie Spirit is Chief Executive Officer of Diversity Partners, a specialist consultancy that she founded in 2009. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Katie Spirit.
Well, hello everyone, and yes, after all of that grim news, I think we'll make sure that this session is a little bit more about some of the opportunities that we have in our industry to kind of deal with some of the challenges we have around diversity, and to make sure we're kind of connecting to some of the shifts that are happening now and shifts in the future. Whenever we come and talk to groups like yourselves or executive teams or boards in Australia and they hear the word diversity, what do you reckon the first thing that they think we're going to be talking about? Anyone want to have a go? Gender, yeah. So gender diversity is often this first automatic assumption that diversity is going to be about gender, which is actually code for women. Not, you know, not always, you know, it's women and men, gender. So one of the things that when we first start to think about diversity is about, well, what does this mean? And in fact, it's way more than gender. Diversity in organisations, the way that corporate organisations in Australia overseas are focusing, is diversity is about diversity, leveraging our diversity of our thinking and diversity of our background. And what do we mean by that? Diversity of background, different identities, gender, age, culture, flexibility, disability, ability, sexual orientation. So these are all the things that we often think it would be around this. We use the term identity diversity. But there's also another element of diversity that organisations are focusing on, and I think one in which is really relevant for us here today, and that is cognitive diversity, diversity of thinking. So we're really looking at diversity of thinking and diversity of background, because what all the research in this field shows us is that that's going to give us enormous benefits in business. That's going to lead us to the new ideas, to the innovation that we need to grapple with some of the challenges that you've already heard this morning. That's going to lead us to overall better commercial performance, as a lot of the business benefits data shows about why diversity is important to us. And it's going to lead us to a whole range of benefits in terms of overall governance, overall quality of decision making. So there's enormous evidence showing that diversity of thinking and diversity of background improves the quality of our decision making and leads to better commercial performance. So there's some really clear business drivers for a focus on diversity in our industry. One of the things I like to do whenever we talk about diversity is just even to kind of make this real. In fact, there's one other thing I forgot to say. When organisations, when we come in, they think, oh, it's going to be about gender diversity code for women. Why, if I'm a man, why would I be interested? Okay, so we're getting that it's kind of a lot broader than that. There's another kind of automatic assumption that we know. People think, oh, I've got to be really politically correct. I can't ask any questions. You know, I'm thinking all these things, but I know I can't ask them. Hopefully Michael's going to make sure you ask some of those questions, because if we feel we have to be politically correct in this field, it hampers good questions and dialogue. And the best thing we know are when we're having conversations with executives and team members around Australia, whether it's out in the Hunter Valley and BHP's mine sites or in the boardrooms in Melbourne and Sydney, the best thing is to have a good conversation, a meaningful conversation about why diversity of thinking and background is important, and what might we as a team, what might I as an individual be doing to inhibit some of that diversity of thinking and background. But let me come back to, if we to understand diversity, let's even start with ourselves, people in the room. Now, I haven't even checked with the organisers if I'm allowed to do this, but let's here goes. What I'm going to do is a little activity, tiny activity, that's we're just going to understand the diversity of backgrounds of people in the room. And so I'm just going to invite you to stand up where you are or stay seated with a couple of questions. But just a moment, stay seated. It's all right. I can see you're all ready to stretch, but don't worry. Okay, if you work in the insurance industry, may I get you to stand up, please? We're just going to notice, look around, how many? Whew, right, excellent. All right, have a look around. We've got a pretty clear majority of people. Thank you very much. If you don't work in the insurance, sit down, please. And if you don't work in the insurance industry, can I get you to stand up? Michael, you're leading the charge there. Okay. All right, so we're just noticing we've got a pretty clear majority and a pretty clear minority just at this little dimension. Thank you very much. Have a seat. If you were born in Australia, can I get you to stand up, please? Have a look around, looking at numbers, just noticing. Have a seat, please. If you were born outside Australia, please stand up. Have a look around. Right. All right. Okay. That's really, that's about sort of 60%, a bit of, okay. So thank you. When we're doing that activity in boardrooms, do you reckon it's a, yeah, okay. By the laughs, you kind of, you get where I was going. In fact, we did that with, a sort of tier two bank, which will remain nameless, and it was a conference of all of their regional managers, and we did that activity. One of the strategic objectives of this bank was moving into Asia, you know, leveraging the Asian market, financial services. Of the 75 managers, we had all those born in Australia here and born outside Australia here. We had one born outside Australia. It's the companies trying to really understand and leverage the Asian market. Just even doing that activity helps us to notice. And it's not bad, it's not wrong, but it is about noticing what perspectives might we be missing. Okay, let's keep going. So we've had a look at insurance, cultural diversity. Let's have a look at gender. Could I ask all the women in the room to stand up, please? Thank you. Have a look around, looking at majorities and minorities as well, just looking around. Thank you very much. Have a seat. Can I ask the men in the room to stand up, please? Have a look around. All right, have a look around. Interesting. Yeah, okay, great. Have a seat. Thank you. Again, we're noticing. We're noticing majorities, minorities, groupings, we're not putting any judgments on this. We're just noticing. Who do you reckon notices, in fact, if you're in the majority or if you're in a minority? Who notices first? Who notices minority? Yeah. Yeah. Again, minority notes. So if we're in the majority, we don't notice often that there's less of these people. We won't necessarily pick up on certain things, just how it is. And yes, you'll see you're in the minority and majority in lots of these different ways. Let's do another activity. Now, I'm assuming you've been honest today. This one you may want to fudge. Let's have a look at age in a nice broad way. If you are in your 20s, can I get you to stand up, please? Oh, you're so lucky. Whew. All right, have a look around. All right, you are our next generation leading the way. Well done. Thank you. Have a seat. If you are in your 30s, please stand. Right. Okay. Have a look around. Great. Thank you. Have a seat if you're in your 40s. Have a look around. Okay. Thank you. Oh, let's just say if you're in your 50s and over. Thank you. Beautiful. I'm standing with you. Okay, having a look around. Great. Fantastic. Now, you know, you could say, is that really important? But, of course, this is the first time in corporate history we've got four generations in the workplace. And, of course, managing people, those of us, not us, you're right, in their 20s, those of you in your 20s, are probably going to be looking for different benefits, different, you're coming to work with a whole set of different aspirations. As heaps of the CEOs we work with say, well, you kind of just want to be here for 2 weeks and then you want to be the CEO. Whereas, you know, many of us have realised that there's a heck of a lot more to do. So age is one that we often look at. Flexibility. If you work flexible work arrangements, and I'll let you define what we mean by flexibility. If you work some form of flexible work arrangement, because you would see in the press all the time this focus that a lot more people are looking for greater flexibility, and of course we have a lot of the tools to give us much more flexibility in these increasingly agile work environments. So if you work some form of flexible work arrangement, please stand up. And have a look around. Okay, great. Just really look around, including those people who are sitting down. Just look around. What do you notice? It might be a bit of a surprise. Anyone? Older. What about men and women? Have a seat. Thank you. So it's mixed men and women. If we did that activity 10 years ago, which we used to, who do you reckon was standing up? Women, and not just women, well, women, but and mothers. And this whole assumption was that workplaces, that flexibility was for mothers. Of course, that's changed enormously. So You could be thinking, well, yeah, you know, this is diversity, this is just how it is. But what's really important is how do our organisations and our how do we respond to these changes, not just in our employee demographics, but our customer demographics as well. And I think the biggest reason why this is important is this focus on innovation. The diversity, not just identity, but diversity of our how we approach decisions. Do we go for process? If we're about to make a major decision, is your first instinct to think, oh, I wonder what the outcome of this is going to be? Or is your first instinct to think, what's the people impact on this? And what we know is that when we can get a balance of thinking approaches in decisions, that's the greatest benefit. So diversity has a lot of benefits in terms of diverse teams are known to outperform homogenous teams of the smartest individuals. Diverse teams outperform homogenous teams even with the best individuals at solving problems. So I think that's a really important learning for us in our industry, the importance of getting that diversity. And why, particularly in our field, groupthink. You know, groupthink, that tendency to pull together. What gets in the way of diversity? Unconscious biases, affinity bias, that tendency to want to gravitate to people who are like ourselves. We do it. I did it on the weekend. I'm at a party. I want to gravitate to the people who are like me, and we can chat about our teenagers and how unruly they are. That's easy. But in the workplace, it's easy to gravitate to people who are like us and make those connections, but there are some downsides. And the downsides is when we're moving to that group think, that people agree with us. There's another one, confirmation bias. I do it all the time. I love when people confirm my views and don't challenge it. Gee, I'm thinking Trump effect here, but no, I won't go there. Confirmation bias is this whole, when we're making a decision, we look for people who are going to confirm our views rather than challenge. So one of the things I think as individuals in this area is to think about as an individual, what biases may I have? We're all biased. And all of these biases can get in the way of good quality decision making and diversity progress. So I think our, you know, challenges for us as individuals, what biases might I have? And as an organisation, how can I make sure that we're leveraging diversity to meet the needs of our very, very diverse customer base? Thank you.